Welcome to the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. The rise of AI presents important legal and ethical challenges for society. In this podcast, we invite leaders from different industries and creators of new AI to debate the big questions. This is the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this podcast. I'm here today with Scott Bells. Scott is a technology enthusiast, leading senior executive. Scott is a global leader in a cutting-edge arena known as the digital shift, encompassing innovation, culture, design, and technology in a digital world. As trusted strategic advisor, Scott thrives on the intersection between cultural and behavior changes in the face of technology innovations and how those reshape industries. Scott enjoys helping leaders navigate accelerated change and complexity in the digital economy. And as a digital warrior, Scott has found a way to mesh a fascination with people and what motivates them together with a raw enthusiasm for technology. As a multiple-time best-selling author, Scott has appeared at TED Talk, Social Media Week, Google Think, Fun Forum, Asian Banker, Next Money, and a long list of private events. His thought leadership has appeared in Wire, an Australian Financial Review, and E27. Hi, Scott. It's very good to have you here today. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to connect and have a conversation today.
Great. I think a good place to start might be exploring a little bit more about your work. It sounds very interesting. It's very much an intersection of technology and financial services, but also you have a lot of interest around culture and encouraging equality. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so back in the early 2000s, I was quite lucky to work for an Australian bank that heavily supported studies outside work. I was lucky to work on both, had a technology postgrad degree and a business postgrad degree, but that gave me the chance to apply those learnings within the financial services sector between sort of 1999 and 2008. And just through, being in the right place at the right time, I was given an opportunity to be on a number of projects that were changing banking. That kind of laid the foundations for me before I went into some more entrepreneurial and innovative ventures. So I had a fantastic opportunity to work for that bank in Cambodia to build a banking model for emerging markets, which is today called Wing Money, one of the most successful mobile money deployments in the world. Then went and built a technology company in South Africa, which Visa acquired to be a part of their emerging markets mobile payments division, built a digital bank in the United States called Movin, and then went on to build a progressive community within the banking space called Next Money with a couple of other guys. But the good thing is around there is it allowed me to stay on the sort of cutting edge around what's happening in the space. And while we have these bunch of, all these buzzwords and hype circles around fintech and digital transformation and innovation, what really fascinated me was where the signals in the market were coming around how industries change. And if we look at every single disruptive business, whether it's Netflix, Uber, Airbnb, no matter what it is in what industry, the key enabling factor actually is not the technology, but it's actually the behavioral change that impacts on both the consumer and the ways of work in that industry. And so that's where my fascination went. And particularly, I was a very early fan of the Lean Startup Movement by Eric Ries. And it basically works on the idea of hypothesizing around goals, problems, pain points, and how you solve for those, as a key input for how you build products and services to have a stronger product market fit. And that's been the core of my work in the last 10 years as an advisor and consultant around digital transformation and innovation in financial services. It's something I quite enjoy because there's a lot of really cool opportunities there to learn the intricacies and the differences and the diversities that exist country by country, culture by culture, religion by religion. Like, you know, what you might learn in Pakistan could then be translated to how you apply that in Brazil and then over to maybe Swaziland in Africa and up to the European Union. And it's a good way of actually realizing that there is similarities, there's differences, but actually the magic is in the diversity of how we solve problems differently around the world.
Okay, yeah, very interesting. And so this diversity of how we solve problems, in a way, this becomes rather very relevant when we look at technologies and how quickly they can travel. And specifically, you know, I guess I wanted to bring this conversation more into AI. How do you see that approach in about how we can collaborate and bring you know, this collaboration to solve these problems across different places, even if it means you know, culturally or, you know, even values might be different in different regions, right? So how do we work to find a common ground?
Yeah, and so I think one of the most important lessons that I've learned in the last 10 years, it's actually known as the first principle of lean enterprise, and that is to assume you know nothing. One of the biggest challenges in the adoption of any technology is that we bring so much bias and historical experience to the table that often will blind us from a broader perspective or broader curiosity around what potentially could happen. And this is both on the positive and the negative side. And so if I look at, for instance, AI right now, AI has a lot of apprehension around fear. And that fear actually comes from historical experience around a fearful adoption of technology somewhere else. So it might be a privacy breach or a data breach that somebody's had or a credit card scam. And so a lot of those things bring fear into the adoption mindset. And so if I go back to what I spoke about in terms of diversity, culture, and I also include curiosity there, is it? If we look at AI with an optimistic curiosity, we actually can see that it actually has amazing potential. And we can get past this fear of robots are gonna take our jobs or Skynet's gonna, you know, launch a war against the human race. Because if we implement AI with a pessimistic mindset, we are going to implement rules and governance structures that remain pessimistic. And so, in fact, the pessimistic mindset has been what's been one of the key limiting factors on the adoption of blockchain in various industries, because blockchain is meant to be an open, trustless ecosystem. But if they get adopted by people that want to control them and put them in closed loops, you'll lose the value of the technology. And so when we look at AI, I'm hoping the same thing doesn't repeat, and that we take an open mind and open curiosity, understand cultural models, understand behavior models, understand the differences in technology adoption in different markets around the world. AI actually can have a very strong positive impact. I just recently watched YouTube has a fantastic series on artificial intelligence, which is hosted by Robert Downey Jr. and looks at the progress of artificial intelligence in a number of different areas. So agriculture, health, food, space, and there's some amazing projects happening around the world. One of them was that really, you know, was mind-blowing to me was how Google's, I think they call it Google Brain is the project. It's their artificial intelligence lab. And it's looking at using voice synthesis AI for the translation of language, not to go say from Chinese to English, but they're looking at a very famous footballer who's developed ALS. And so with ALS, he has language challenges. His patterns almost become unrecognizable in basic English. And so his ability to communicate, to interact with other human beings is limited. But what they've actually created is they take his, let's say, restricted ALS language skills into a translation, so that goes into text, and then brings the text back to voice. Now, he's as a very public footballer, there is an abundance of video and audio files on him as a, you know, growing up. And actually they're using his voice synthesis to retranslate. So he speaks in his, you know, restricted ALS, what he has left. It goes into text and then comes back out as voice in his original voice. And so seeing that application of AI gives me amazing optimism for where it actually could take us.
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? And that brings me to a conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago, which was around education. And I think we were both talking about how we, you know, we're raising our kids to be bilingual, for example. And, you know, these are perhaps some of the things that, you know, although, of course, there's still benefits of being raised bilingual for the brain. In practice, this technology now makes it, you know, life much easier in the sense that we not even need translators anymore, right? We'll be able to translate things in real time. And that combined with, I guess, the challenge that we have in the education system and in raising kids to understand this new world that we're going to be living in, you know, when there's predictions of 60% of the jobs that we now know will likely not exist, and we will have new jobs being created as technology progresses. And, you know, if we all being honest, we still don't know what they were going to be like. It's very hard to predict. So I know you're quite passionate about this area and you've been doing work in education space. So what is your point of view in relation to all this?
Yeah, so if we look at the core potential of AI in that, you know, the machine learning or you know, domain-specific machine learning has the ability to automate and make optimize existing logic. And so most of the education today is based on existing logic. This is the curriculum for a grade one, a grade three, a grade five. But one of the challenges I've always had is us as human beings recognizing the opportunities to have an accelerated or a decelerated journey through that process to cater for individual needs. And so if you look at particularly, you know, like I just mentioned before, I've just completed an updated course on Coursera. And Coursera allows to cater for a journey either way in terms of our interactions, our pace, our availability. And I see education changing a lot in that way. Andrew Ng, who is actually not only the founder of Coursera, but also the founder of DeepLearning.ai, who I did the course with, he's a strong advocate on a change in education, and that is a traditional institution in the education space uses their, what they call their professionals, to deliver content, okay? And also then the embedding of that content. And so if I think about in the university context, that means you have a professor who delivers a lecture. He's probably been delivering that same lecture for 10, 15, 20 years. He sees every cohort come in and go. And then he uses either TAs or whatever to actually embed that through the labs or the practical sessions. The model that a lot of the progressive minds are now looking at is a flipping of that, of saying, okay, look, actually the professor is really good at applying it. In fact, if we want to progress any domain, we need these academics to be involved in the application process more. So the professor can turn his lectures essentially into content that can be consumed as fast and whatever delivery mechanism suits the individual learner. But then they work with the professors themselves and their support networks on the application of that learning. So whether it's artificial intelligence or basic mathematics in primary school, we can basically flip the model. But the cool thing about this is it means that, so I'm a big advocate of project-based learning. So instead of using just examinations and tests to test the progress of learning, is looking at how do we do projects? We could actually build projects with support of AI, either in terms of feedback loops, gamification, various support structures to cater for the individuals to move through their learning journey. And one of the things that we need to think about in here is that if you go back 20, 30 years when most academic programs were designed, essentially you had almost a static delivery and a static assessment of the acceptance of that delivery. We now have the ability to say, okay, here is a bunch of content. How you apply this can be up to you. And we can actually essentially enable the curiosity of the learner where they could apply it into any domain. So if they were doing something in mathematics, there is no reason why they couldn't apply. And let's say they're in a rural community. They come from an agriculture or farming background. There is no reason why a year five student couldn't be applying his mathematics learning in an agricultural or farming context, which is very relevant to his world. All of a sudden it makes his physical world around him, his immersive experience for learning. Similarly, someone who lives in an urban or a city environment, they use the environments that give them passion so that their projects and application can be specific to their context. And so I actually see that education is going to change a lot with support of AI, particularly around the contextualization of a learning journey or a learning pathway from primary years through to postgraduate.
Mm. So, and in a way that can actually support equality, right? I think one of the things that we wanted to discuss here today is about a lot of your work is around supporting equality with the rise of technology, right? And in a way, we can see how this can really help us to do that. So on the other hand, what are the concerns there in regards to inequality as technology progresses, and how do you think we need to navigate that?
Yeah, so I think, and this is something that came up in the program that I was just doing with Andrew Ung, is around the biggest restriction on technology actually is the mindset in which the designers or the innovators bring to the table. So if you get an innovator who comes from a single cultural background, I'll give an example. So you get a white male who comes from a very Christian background, who is very Western mindset, very first world, that in itself has the ability to create a bias within any technology that they design. And so I think this is, and you mentioned before around the idea of bringing our children up as bilingual. Just by being bilingual, they have another perspective, and we can add layers to that to add diversity, to have particularly around culture, country, religion, all these kind of things. Like, I think about this as, so my kids go to an international school here, and I mean, actually in Singapore, we celebrate Muslim holidays, Christian holidays, Hindu holidays. And so I think about in Australia, where I originally come from, that my children would never get a chance to experience, okay, what is Hari Raya? Like that is a slight diversity, and that brings a broader mindset to the design process and the mindset of any technology. And so what I hope is that artificial intelligence will give consideration for those broader perspectives in the design process, particularly around culture, religion, national identity things. Like, I mean, culture has a huge impact on shaping the way we see the world. So for instance, if I look at all the challenges that we've seen around same-sex marriage, women's rights, even racism right now, but most of those limitations come from historical cultural embedding, and that basically we saw that, you know, a female's role was in the kitchen. They had to change that cultural model in order to design for it and bring about gender equality. That same challenge will come into the design process of how we invent and innovate with things like artificial intelligence, because the models, instead, the models that underline artificial intelligence still require us to design them. Yes, these models can learn on themselves, but we have to design them. And so if we bring our bias into the design process, we potentially design those biases in the systems perpetually. And my hope is that we can avoid those.
Yeah, absolutely. And bringing back to our current example, I guess, finding the pandemic, one of the things that we are learning from it is that, a lot of different technologies have been used across the world to, you know, fight and manage the virus. And some have been effective, but end of the day, we still need that environment to support those technologies. Technology on its own will not solve our problems, right? And in the same way, yes, with the problem of bias, for example, it still works as a mirror, right? So it's just reflecting the current biases that we have in society.
I think one of the things I'm observing, and this is looking at how the pandemic has affected different countries under different leadership models, under different cultural models, is a lot of the bias that's being created, or the messages that are in the community, are very subjective. Like, they lack an objective measure in terms of what's right, what's wrong, you know, what's the right number to follow, what's the wrong number to follow. And so my hope is that artificial intelligence, in its amazing potential, objectifying our view of the world, to essentially remove the subjectivity. Because if you could take a lot of the subjectivity out, we can remove some of the challenges like dramatization, hysteria, fear, fake news. Is my hope that, you know, artificial intelligence can help essentially decline the impact those things have on key issues like how we manage a pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we look at challenges like what just happened in the US this week in respect to racism, for example, and now that we have society waking up to some of those bigger issues, perhaps in a way we can use, you know, technology and artificial intelligence to, you know, be a new tool that we can actually, you know, carefully, if we mold that, we can, you know, insert values about, you know, what's right, what's wrong, in a way.
Yeah, I think, and also in that comes a challenge is who decides what's right and wrong? Because if we look at the design process of any technology, essentially the inventor gets to decide what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm. But the hope is that artificial intelligence can demonstrate some degree of separation from those design biases so that we can overcome those challenges. I mean, it's not a day goes by where Trump doesn't make the news, and the way his opinions polarize the world have huge impact on opinion, debate, hysteria, mad passionate supporters. Like, you have everything that comes out of that, and the challenge we have is who essentially gets to decide what's right and wrong? Because essentially, Trump is the leader of the free world, gets to decide for himself what's right and wrong. And that's meant to be the potential of AI.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we look at problems, you know, we have very real problems now that we need to come in agreement with, and that's very relevant to self-driving cars, for example, right? We do need eventually, we need to decide about, you know, what should a self-driving car do? If, you know, should it behave like a human would, right? And making decisions very quickly, you know, where to turn, or in saving lives, right? In the same way, bringing back this conversation to your experience in working with startups and innovating, right? So how do we ensure that, innovators, like you're saying, have sometimes, well, most of the time, the power to determine how to make this decision? So, and from what I see, a lot of the times they struggle with that because they might have started with the good intention of creating something which can be used for good. But sometimes the market still doesn't quite support that. So, you know, early startups have the challenge of raising funds and have to kind of be more flexible about the intentions. So that is a very real challenge. And I feel when we talk about AI for good, how do we really encourage that, you know, the people would develop such tools for that use, right?
Yeah, and I think this is a debate that's been going on for more than just a couple of years, even prior to the existence of AI. The way I label it, this is purpose versus profit. Is every founder starts with a very clear purpose in mind around what they're intending to do with their startup. The very public case we've all watched in the last decade has been Facebook. And so if you go and watch the movie The Social Network, you get the message of an individual that was very purpose-driven about connecting people and building communities. It's a good message. But then if you go and watch, so Netflix has a documentary right now called The Great Hack, which basically talks about the
Cambridge Analytic.
Yeah, Cambridge Analytica, sorry. And so that actually looks at that as almost a demon. And that demon really comes out of turn what was originally a fantastic purpose into a profit. And so you have this tug of war happening, and this happens in every industry. It's not isolated to Facebook. Is how do you manage, you know, this purpose versus profit equation as we build the technologies and businesses that will, you know, shape the rest of the world? And this is going to be even more vitally important when you look at something that's almost, AI is almost self-sustaining. So if the purpose isn't very clear, it doesn't have a strong ethics and moral compass, that the profitability model could actually create a bias that, you know, essentially destroys it. Well, not so much destroys it, but creates almost a demon in itself. So those challenges will be real for a lot of these AI enabled startups, you know, in the coming decade, essentially.
Yeah. So what's your usual advice when working with these companies around, you know, what they're creating and how they ensure that they stay on track with their purpose?
Yeah. And so, I mean, if I look at the companies that I've been advising and working with over the last 10 years, most startups are very good at building advisory boards for profitability and strategy. That's not an issue for many businesses. But how they build an early advisory board around purpose, which is almost independent of the profit component, so they can have those debates, they can ask, is this moral, is this ethical, is this good for society, is trying to encourage more businesses to essentially have that secondary advisory board around purpose, so that you can involve, like, this is a great role for particularly academics in the world that are used to asking these questions, to have, you know, advocates of diversity, to have advocates of cultural acceptance, to have advocates of morals and ethics, actually provide an active voice in these advisory discussions around the direction of a business. And I'm not saying it's going to fix everything, but if a founder is at least getting a balanced perspective, they've at least, you know, taken in all these perspectives and making consideration around their priorities, their investments, their growth strategies as it goes forward. And I think, you know what, right now, that's going to be the best case we can do, is just make sure that the people that are making the decisions on the direction of a business are getting the most balanced perspective in terms of their advice they seek. And so I think this is a big call out to the venture capital parts of the world, private equity, is saying, okay, I understand that your bias is particularly around the profitability of a venture, but, you know, if you look at where the likely bias of where society is going around investment thesis is, we're going to have to give more consideration to ethics, morals, positive impact on society, and have to ask their portfolios, do they actually have an active voice to guide their founders through those very tough and challenging discussions?
Yeah. And what else could you say about what, you know, what else needs to be done in respect of the market? Or maybe you can even speak in specific about the, you know, financial industry, given your experience. I know in specific we had some latest developments there in Singapore in respect of, you know, the intersection of finance and AI. So do you see that as improvements in the area, or do you worry that it might perhaps, like you were referring to before, it might perhaps you know, work in the same way as cryptocurrency in terms of limiting the technology?
So I think we have a bit of a both. I mean, I would put AI in a very different bucket to cryptocurrency, because the cryptocurrency community, I would say, has not done a very good job of including the broader communities and financial communities in their adoption cycle. Artificial intelligence really comes down to where you apply it. And so if I look at where most people are applying artificial intelligence today in finance, that's typically in a customer service, so chatbots and so forth, where, you know, like, most of those parts are already fairly well regulated in terms of what an institution has to do around serving a customer, whether it is with a call center or a chatbot, is, you know, essentially the same. The other part is it's been used in more financial product selection and navigation, so which is essentially financial advice. In Singapore, we have a fairly robust financial advisory regulation, which means the potential of any artificial intelligence in, say, wealth management, portfolio allocations, share trading, and so forth, will still come under the scrutiny of that financial advisory regulation. And I think that's a good place to start. I do think we're going to have some regulatory changes to adopt a more AI-driven financial advisory discussion, essentially because if you think about this, it's easier to design out bias and commercial motivation in financial advice when it becomes AI. And so most of the regulation in that space today is about how do you manage conflict of interest, bias, commercial motivations within the financial advisory process so that we aren't giving people loans they can't afford or offering products that don't fit their risk appetite. That's what most of the regulation managers today is that has a potential to be more accelerated and more objective in an AI world. So I think that's going to be one component. The part we've been watching with curiosity is kind of on the investment bank and market side is, we've over the last 10 years, we've looked at algorithmic trading, sentiment-based trading, like latency-based trading, as I think artificial intelligence is just going to accelerate that. So if you look at things like Moore's law and Metcalfe's law in terms of the acceleration of computational power, and then what the factor of AI does on top of that, I think we're just going to see those things be almost a zero-sum game. If you look at businesses in financial services, they're still heavily dependent on arbitrage and margin. You're looking at zero-sum competitive situations, whether it's foreign exchange, commodities. Those spaces are essentially going to be a race to the bottom because artificial intelligence will be doing a huge amount of the heavy lifting. But what it's important is the displacement of people then in those businesses, what becomes their value? I firmly believe that job roles will become redundant. People will be given the opportunity to actively choose a career development or learning pathway to reinvent their career. So people that were doing very routine or task-oriented roles in financial services would be best placed right now to figure out, okay, I can do this now, but how can I do that for 10 times more capacity or 100 times more capacity if I'm partnered with an AI? So that's going to be a key component in the financial services around the displacement of people, but actually the transformation of people and skills overall. So they're the three themes that I'm actively following in the financial services space right now. There is a fourth one, which is probably more long-term, and that is financial services is basically a big accounting book. It has assets and liabilities and a whole bunch of products and infrastructure that balances those books. The complexity of those today, both on the institutional side and the retail side, is essentially the inheritance of hundreds of years of products, risk, and compliance to turn those underlying books into a commercial model and distribute them. I'm anticipating with AI that we're going to see far better things around what we call, so cash management is one of the most important parts of banking, because it basically determines where your dollars sit to be productive or unproductive within the financial system. Now, big institutional customers have teams of people actively managing their cash position to get the best return for their cash, so the best return for their dollar. Is with AI, we have the potential to making that same cash management strategy to be scalable even at a retail level. To the point where I think it's foreseeable in the next 10 years that your average household with across their mortgages, so their secured loans, their unsecured loans, their deposits and their investments could almost have AI managing the allocations to ensure the best performance of their assets and liabilities, which essentially is the scalability of the core parts of cash management. But I think that's going to be a longer term sort of 10-year thing.
Okay, so we really see a lot of potential there in the financial industry, right? For what can be done with technology. How do you see that How do you see that unfolding now, given, you know, that once we come out of COVID-19, you know, technology, I suppose, starts to stabilize again. How do you see that helping us, or do you see a slow, you know, a slowdown process in terms of, you know, advancements?
Yeah, so I think we're going to see what I'm calling a two-paced race post the pandemic. And that is, and it boils down to the mindsets of the leaders within those businesses. For the businesses that have been cash hoarding, cost cutting, what I call the pessimistic leaders, they will essentially look to just bring business back to where it was before. And they will slowly, incrementally come out of the pandemic. Now that is a safe, very risk adverse strategy, but I don't believe it's the one that's going to really thrive right now. The one I'm watching right now is what I call the optimistic leader. And so they are people that saw the downturn as an opportunity to position themselves to accelerate out of the pandemic. So if you read any of these kind of wealth books, whether it's by I think Tony Robbins has a book, but he interviewed like Buffett and a few other people around how you prepare for winter. Okay, so what do you do in a winter period? And so this pandemic is winter. And it's essentially is the best time to invest is winter because everything's cheap.
Absolutely.
I think the example.
And other people are distracted.
Yeah. And so I think that the example in Tony's book was the cheapest time to buy a Ferrari is in winter. Not that I'm about to buy a Ferrari, but it's an example of saying, okay, the best time to buy things is during a downturn. And so the optimistic leader was looking for opportunities to accelerate their businesses, whether it's in skills, investment allocation, new lines of business, because what the pandemic has done is it's optimized a whole lot of businesses. You've had to, like just to survive, businesses have had to optimize. Now for the people then stay remain on the optimistic side, they've said, okay, not only am I going to optimize, but I'm going to look for positions that are going to accelerate me out the other side. So if you look at particularly future ways of work, future customer segments, profitability and distribution, across any industry, the people that have made active investments in positions that will accelerate out, they will literally accelerate be faster than any of their peers. Now, the one thing we already know, China has been doing this because they were the first to go into the pandemic, the first to come out. They've seen this opportunity. Like Shenzhen as a technology hub will accelerate past Silicon Valley now. It already is a superpower with, you know, the number of companies that are there, but because they came out of the pandemic early, because they have the potential and they are basically the supply chain of the world, they will accelerate out of this pandemic. I think that the trend that I'm going to hypothesize is we are going to see an accelerated shift from the West to the East as we come out of the pandemic.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah. I mean, I think things were
really because of the power. Sorry, go on.
And I absolutely agree. Sorry, we got cut out there for a second. And I was going to say this, and I think this was the way that we were going before, even before the pandemic, in terms of how China is really leading into, you know, developments in AI and other technologies. They really do hold most of the data. I think we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah. Like if I look at where is the highest concentration of artificial intelligence technology, it's Shenzhen. It's in one city. If I think about edge computing power, which is vitally important for making AI work, if I look at, you know, the computational power, the storage requirements to make AI work, the IoT devices, like all those things are concentrated in one city. And so I see Shenzhen's role in the next 2 years. Yes, you're right. We were already shifting there. This will just accelerate it.
Yeah. So, and obviously for, I guess, us here in the APAC, being close to China is probably a good place to be right now. How do you see companies that are benefiting more of this situation at the moment? How do you think that they should approach this upcoming change?
Yeah, so historically I've been an active observer of the Singapore versus Hong Kong roles in the world. Hong Kong historically had an amazing competitive advantage being so close to China. They were kind of the Western gateway. The challenges though with the protests, with COVID and with the current challenges, Hong Kong's ability to remain that role could be challenged, which still have very strong Chinese ties, very easy for Western countries to deal with based on British common law. So we at least have a framework for doing commercial business. As I see, particularly Southeast Asia as being a hotbed of innovation in the coming 2 to 3 years, as not only innovation for its own economy, so within the ASEAN economies, but also as regional headquarters for either global companies or as gateways to Europe and the United States. Because, I mean, it's no huge secret, as you know, Trump has his anti-Chinese sentiment war going on right now. All that's happening is, it means instead of directing, you know, commercial traffic through Hong Kong and Taiwan, it's now coming through Singapore, Malaysia, as a means to getting around the anti-Chinese sentiment. And so as a result, you're going to see a lot of Australian technology sourcing coming through Singapore, a lot of European technology sourcing coming through Singapore, as a fantastic hotbed. So I think, and the Singapore government is very good at investing in kind of IP and hub development. And so I feel that there'll be a huge amount of investment in this space. So EDB is our economic development board. They will have recognized this already, of saying, okay, we want to invest in skills, capability, and technology for being known as an AI hub. Like, they've done a great job in the last 5 years in getting it positioned as a fintech hub. I think AI might be the next one.
Great. And Singapore has us investing a lot when it comes to upskilling people, which is something that you touched on a little bit before there. They have this project which is called Future Skills, in preparing people and with new skills that they will need, and also I guess bringing some awareness about the soft skills that will be crucial, right, preparing for the future. So that preparation that, you know, you're referring to, that people need to make, do you see that's being enough? What else needs to be done there?
Yeah, so there's a number of agencies that actually work on the enablement of that. There is Enterprise Singapore, which works in the small to medium enterprise space. There is SG Innovate, which is doing a lot of technology R&D and startup facilitation. There's the Monetary Authority working in the fintech space. There is the Singapore Tourism Board that's now launching a massive program around digital transformation of tourism. So there's a number of industries with big, deep pockets to make that happen. But I think this is where the mindset of Singapore becomes important, is that Singapore is one of the few governments in the world that is actually a profitable business. It's, you know, it looks everything as a commercial model. And so if we look at Future Skills as a program, yes, there is a goodwill, moral, you know, help our people message to it. But just as equally powerful is the Ministry of Finance and the Economic Development Board see that if we invest in our people, we can grow our, you know, GDP per capita, we can grow the income level of our domestic population, we can attract even more talent, we can attract even more IP and actually grow the economy overall. So they will be looking at the skills development as an economic opportunity for the country. Now, a lot of countries do that around the world. It's just not as effective as what Singapore has been doing. And so I would see that a lot of the investments we're seeing right now from various Singaporean government agencies, there will be an economic stimulus component to it, but also a kind of good for the people component as well. And it's finding a very good balance. Like, you know, like I use the Future Skills program all the time to you know, enroll in either local education, workshops, seminars. You know, I frequently speak at events for various associations here. I've spoken at SG Innovate multiple times. Again, just engaging the community in a dialogue around where things are going. Like, we actually just had one a couple of months ago on the future skills required with AI and finance. So we're looking at the future of talent and culture in the finance space. We had a fantastic, you know, discussion there. There was a lady from Price Waterhouse, a lady from OCBC, one of the large banks here. You know, we had a fantastic discussion around what individuals can do to empower themselves to not only future-proof their skills, but also improve their future economic status as well.
Yeah. And what would you say was the takeaway there in terms of the key skills that people need in an intersection of AI and finance?
You know what? It's not even a skill that they require. It's more primitive than that. And that is transformation. This is like AI is not the first transformation in history. We've seen multiple. We've gone from the small farm to the commercial farm, so the industrialization of farming. We saw railroads globalize the world. We've seen a number of transformations in history. Is time and time again, the evidence shows that the people that own their own self-transformation will thrive. Okay, and so the core message that came out of that is the Singapore government has an abundance of programs on offer, future skills, subsidy programs, like all these programs are available. But all those programs are completely useless if the individual doesn't choose to own their own learning transformation. They have to know what they want to learn, where they want to work in the future. It doesn't matter if it's artificial intelligence, deep learning, engineering, like all those skills, but the person themselves has to own their own transformation. It's never going to work for an individual to assume the government owes me this. Mm-hmm. The government has to help me. It's an individual responsibility to choose your own pathway forward. There's always options. We discussed openly. It's like you can learn any skill you want for free on YouTube. I mean, literally, you could probably build a rocket and go to space. Like that's one of the most hardest scientific challenges on the planet. But I'm pretty sure that a couple of months a couple of years on watching YouTube videos, you could learn how to put a rocket into space. And so there's more than enough resources there to give people the skills, the experience that they require. What has to happen first is they have to choose to learn.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think COVID-19 really has pushed that even more. We now have, courses from Harvard being made available online for anyone to take from, anywhere. So what a great opportunity that is.
I think one of the key things that as a society that will really define the next 10 years, it will be two things which are really on the individual. One is the people that have a mindset for lifelong learning. And so we've seen the two sides of this in the pandemic. You have the people that are going out there and doing fitness challenges and doing online courses, and basically they've taken a growth journey through the pandemic. And you've got a whole bunch of people, I'm sorry to generalize here, but have drunk beer and watched Netflix on the couch, which is the complete opposite end. And the people that have taken on challenges and remain active and stimulating themselves and growing themselves as an opportunity, they will thrive post-pandemic. Where the other people, like they're going to be sick for the first 2 weeks just getting off the couch and having to go back to work. So that's the lifelong learning component. And I think the next one is around what we call micro-credentials. So realizing that you don't have to study something for 3, 4, 5 years in order to be accredited for that learning experience. And this is where I'm a big advocate of platforms like Coursera, because you can go and do a credential over a period of weeks or months and actually get a certificate for it. As I said, I just did my update on my deep learning course with deep learning. I'm 80% through. I'm doing my next level of cloud certification with Google on Google Cloud. So I love learning. So I'm not the same as everyone, but those kind of experiences and those kind of parts of society will really determine where in each individual's journey goes in the next 5 to 10 years as many industries change.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, this might be a good time to wrap things up. Where is the best time for people to find you, Scott? Best place, not just time.
I mean, professionally, the best places to reach me are obviously LinkedIn and Twitter. That's where I'm a person that likes to segment my life. So LinkedIn and Twitter is where I very much have my professional persona. I mean, I still have my website as well, scottebales.com, where they can see the work, the client stuff that I do. But if you want to reach out to me, LinkedIn, Twitter. For those that want a bit more of a behind the scenes personal look at, I project that through Instagram. I'm a person that I'm a fairly open book. So if anyone has any questions around, they're curious about, they want to challenge me on, they think I've missed something or if I've got something wrong, like I don't think I'm right 100% of the time. So challenge me or ask me questions through any of those platforms.
Absolutely. And also, you've recently published your book. When was that again? It's quite recent, right?
Yeah. So last year was my book, Innovation Wars, which focuses on building competitive innovation programs. I take the metaphor of war or warfare. It was originally an attempt on trying to take the example of Sun Tzu's The Art of War. I did a terrible job of the war metaphor and corporate stuff. But it really looks at around the various programs, capabilities, people, strategies that are coming out of the recent push to use innovation for competitive advantage.
Okay. So it's a very timely topic that can help a lot of people right now coming out of COVID-19, really.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Look forward to more conversations.
Thank you for having me.